Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Paul Richardson for an update on multiple myeloma, and to begin, I asked Dr. Richardson to comment on a common question from oncologists in practice, namely whether it makes more sense to use a three-drug combination as initial systemic treatment as opposed to a two-drug regimen and hold other agents in reserve.
It's actually probably one of the most fundamentally important discussion points in myeloma management today. I think the data to support the fact that keeping better treatments in reserve for later may be the wrong approach in symptomatic myeloma is best exemplified by the results of the VISTA trial, which Jesus San Miguel presented at the ASH meeting as an oral session in San Diego in December. And there he showed that with the three-drug regimen of VMP compared to MP, with a median follow-up of 5 years, the survival advantage for the VMP remained highly significant, in excess of 13 months median, compared to the M&P arm, even allowing for substantial crossover with salvage treatments, both including bortezomib and immunomodulatory therapy for the control arm. So in and of itself, it showed that the three-drug combination used early had no penalty, if you will, to clinical benefit later. And Jesus really, I think, showed that very nicely by actually describing the treatments that were used for the patients on the experimental arm, the three-drug arm, VMP, you know, what happened to them when they were treated either with immunomodulatory therapy or with bortezomib again. And again, the response rates were robust and the clinical benefit derived from the salvage strategies appeared very durable, as reflected by the very hard number of a 13.3-month median overall survival advantage with follow-up at 5 years, which for a trial of its kind is actually unprecedented. So I think that that was the sort of top-line data to inform clinicians in the community that using best drug combinations up front doesn't carry with it a penalty later in which therapeutic failure then can occur. So I think that we have now not just theoretical information, Neil, to support the construct that you can use best combinations early, generate your most early by intensifying, consolidating, and maintaining, and then salvage later with similar sort of IMiD proteasome inhibitor backbones, but other drugs added to it. That's always been the theoretical construct.
So another sort of broad conceptual question to get started here relates to the issue of transplant. And you have the trial looking at the question of delayed versus immediate transplant. But in terms of non-protocol approach, I kind of get the feeling talking to investigators over the last year that there's been a shift more towards transplant.
Yes, it's a great question again, Neil. And I think that the reason for that shift towards transplant has been, again, driven by data. There's a very important study led by Antonio Palombo in which he compared lenalidomide and dexamethasone as an induction strategy, 4 cycles, followed then by mobilization of stem cells. And then one arm were assigned to autologous stem cell transplantation with high-dose melphalan, and the other arm were assigned to a combination of melphalan, prednisone, and lenalidomide based upon his MPR regimen, which he has obviously developed really quite successfully in the elderly. And what was seen in this study was a complete equivalence in terms of response rate for induction and intensification in both arms. But what's emerged in this 400-plus patient study with relatively short follow-up, actually, is a significant progression-free survival advantage in favor of transplant. So I think that what we're seeing is that transplant in patients can confer a significant clinical benefit as reflected by progression-free survival in those eligible and young enough to receive it. The important question is, does everybody need that? And also, of course, who can afford to wait? And by the same token as well, the one key piece missing in Antonio's study was, of course, bortezomib. And the reason that's so important is because data was presented at the San Diego meeting showing that in a meta-analysis of randomized trials, bortezomib-based therapy in transplant-eligible patients is actually not only associated with a response rate advantage, but actually, and this was, I think, the key observation, this was from the group in Emory, and it was a very well-done meta-analysis, I have to say. They showed the sort of between-your-eyes observation that actually bortezomib incorporation as part of pre-transplant therapy was associated with an overall survival advantage. So The fact that Antonio's study did not have bortezomib in it, I think, is a weakness in that trial. But having said it, the proof of principle is very important because it suggests that transplant does confer benefit. Because at the end of the day, lenalidomide dexamethasone is a very active doublet. We know that. So, of course, then it comes, well, what other trials are going to help us answer this question? And I think there are a number in process. There's the European Myeloma Network study, which I think is an extraordinarily interesting and well-designed study led again by Pieter Sonnefeld and Antonio. There is also our own IFM Dana-Farber partnership in which we're exploring the role of RVD with early or late transplant. And our hypothesis is that transplant will confer a progression-free survival advantage of at least 9 months in that trial. That's our a priori hypothesis we're testing. And we will see what happens. My suspicion is that the overall results of the trial will be positive, but subsets will show that some patients, or distinct groups of patients, may actually be able to avoid transplant early and keep it in reserve. That's my own bias, but obviously we need the data to be sure that that's true.
What are the situations where you're comfortable having a patient go in the trial, and what are the situations where you're not?
It's a great question. I think right now, based upon the information we have, patients with ISS stage 1 and ISS stage 2 disease probably are best candidates for this study because we do know that those patients with higher ISS stage may in fact need more than just RVD, as it were, to maintain disease control. And why I say that is because based on our phase 1-2 study in 66 patients published in 2010, on that analysis, that's the group that we saw early treatment failure in, those with ISS stage 3 or higher ISS stage 2. Sort of ISS 1s and 2s are probably ideal candidates for participation in the clinical trials. But I have to say, do we know for sure that in the 3s, transplant is the way to go? We absolutely don't, because then what, of course, controls the whole risk analysis in this setting is cytogenetics. And what we do know is that RVD overdrives adverse cytogenetics to some extent, but obviously not completely. And what we do also know from the very interesting data from the HOVM trial is that bortezomib-based treatment is particularly important. And it's not just any, it's the amount and duration of it that's very important in 17p deletion. And why that becomes important, Neil, is this. Because obviously if you have a transplant, it may limit the amount of bortezomib you're able to administer for various reasons, such as toxicities and so forth. And that's very interesting and very important because it may mean that, in fact, if you have 17p deletion, which we know enriches for chemo resistance through the p53 mutation, you know, is that a patient that you really want to alkylate when, in fact, novel biologically derived treatments may actually be the better way to go? And we simply don't know the answer to that. And I think that's why this randomized trial, as one example, the IFM Dana-Farber collaborative effort is so important.
So let's talk about longer term treatment and maybe staying on the trial. I'm curious what happens on the trial in terms of post-transplant maintenance. Is it different if there is abnormal cytogenetics? And what about the patients who aren't getting transplanted? What's the duration of their treatment?
Well, this has been an area of very active debate. In a nutshell, the current study is written for the induction phase being 3 cycles of RVD before mobilization with high-dose cyclophosphamide, which is given at 3 grams with growth factor support. And then arm B, which is the transplant arm, receives high-dose melphalan, 200 mg per meter squared, and then gets consolidated with a further 2 cycles of RVD, followed then by lenalidomide maintenance. The arm A, which is the non-transplant arm, receives RVD to a further 5 cycles, then followed by arm maintenance. Now, obviously, safety first, and in that regard, looking at the CLGB data, we've done very exhaustive work trying to best understand what the impact of lenalidomide may be on this signal of second primaries. And data from the CLGB study suggests that it pretty much disappears after 2 years. And beyond 2 years, we're just simply not seeing anything. And the signal itself is very small. So in the US, because of the CLGB data being so favorable, and most importantly, the CLGB data showing a survival benefit to continuing lenalidomide until progression, we on the US side are very comfortable moving forward with a longer period of maintenance based upon the CLGB data. In France, for various different reasons, there are concerns about longer maintenance. And I think at the moment in the French investigator arena, there is debate between 1 year versus 2 years versus longer. And at the moment, their decision is to hold to the 1 year, at least for now, recognizing that many of them wanted to move to 2 years. But given the debate that exists, I think 1 year for them is what they're choosing. On the US side, we do feel differently, Neil. And in the context of this trial, we're sorting out how we can reconcile that going forward.
So at 2 years or until progression?
Well, in our own maintenance study, Neil, at the moment, I think our investigators are in favor of continuing until progression based on the CLGB data. But for the purposes of the clinical trial that we're doing with our French partners, we have to do it in a way in which we can maintain the integrity of the study vis-a-vis answering the questions in the trial. But at the same time, obviously, we want to put our patients first. And that's the current ongoing discussion. But I'm optimistic that we'll have a resolution to this, which actually may help us answer the question where in the US, for example, there is prolonged maintenance. And in France, they will choose shorter maintenance. And so be it. That's their decision. But it will actually allow us potentially to compare the two groups and say, actually, who does do better? And in a way, that will actually be a very nice silver lining to this challenge, because what it'll do is help us better understand, you know, how long should maintenance be? I should share with you that the CTN, for example, are conducting their lenalidomide maintenance for 3 years. And all the other trials I'm aware of are proceeding with maintenance for at least 2 years. So I think that a maintenance strategy that is longer versus shorter does seem to be where most of the field is moving.
What about the patient with abnormal cytogenetics, for example, 17p?
I think in that group of patients, the data from Pieter Sonnefeld's study, which also, by the way, required maintenance for 2 years in both arms, and showed that whilst thalidomide conferred a benefit, actually, for the 2 years that patients were on thalidomide, actually, the benefit from bortezomib given every 2 weeks in the other arm also was apparent, and particularly in those patients in whom adverse cytogenetics were seen. What was really interesting as well in Pieter's study was that actually the discontinuation rate was higher for thalidomide than it was for bortezomib, suggesting better tolerability to the once every 2 week bortezomib. So to answer your question, it's really interesting, Neil, because I think a number of us feel that the incorporation of bortezomib maintenance, say once every 2 weeks, particularly sub-Q, for example, might be a very interesting way to go in combination with lenalidomide for high-risk cytogenetics. And talking to colleagues and friends in the myeloma community, certainly in the US, I think there's a significant number of us who feel that for high-risk patients as a maintenance strategy, the use of bortezomib every 2 weeks with lenalidomide, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, for example, or continuously, depending on hematologic tolerance, would be very reasonable strategies off protocol, recognizing that obviously participating on protocol is obviously the most important way to go. And obviously, in making any decision about maintenance, the risks, benefits, inconvenience, convenience, all these factors need to be carefully discussed with the patient. One final comment on that is, you know, what sort of magnitude of benefit are we talking about? Well, let's not diminish that. With progression-free survival as the endpoint, you saw median progression-free survival in the lenalidomide-treated patients of about 4 years versus 2 years for those on placebo. And that was the same both in the French and the American experiences. That's huge. And I think that that's an important point when you're discussing it with patients. And in my experience, Neil, when you have that sort of discussion, it helps them best understand the risk-benefit profile.
So I see in Blood, you part of a big paper that's just got electronically published looking at second cancers and a bunch of studies. I guess when you do these kinds of analyses, are you factoring in the fact that the people who get the maintenance are living longer, so they're living longer to be able to get more cancers?
Well, that's quite right. There's ascertainment bias. And I think the important point is that myeloma itself is associated with a higher risk of second primaries because of both immunological deficits and presumably some germline issues that make patients more vulnerable. The other piece is that obviously we've known in myeloma for some time that there's an underlying second cancer risk. This is not a new phenomenon. You know, we all remember the bad old days of continuous melphalan exposure. I remember as a fellow learning about AML-MDS in those patients very early in our training. So I think that it's a very real issue, but I think one has to get it in context. And I think that in my broad experience, and as I say, we're one of the lead enrollers to the CLGB trial, it's interesting to me. In our practice, not one of our patients on lenalidomide has elected to discontinue lenalidomide because of fear of second primaries, just to give you an example.
So you mentioned subcutaneous bortezomib, and I'm curious where you are today in terms of using that strategy and also using weekly dosing of bortezomib.
Yeah, well, I'll start with the last question first, Neil, because that's the easiest. The weekly dosing, I think, has been a major step forward, no question about that. And particularly once, you know, for twice weekly initially to get tumor burden down in a higher risk patient, you know, in a frailer elderly patient starting off weekly so they don't run straight into the side effect profile that obviously is predominantly focused on neuropathy, have been key advances in how we optimize the use of bortezomib. I think the sub-Q story is remarkable. I think it's remarkably positive because it's some lovely clinical innovation led by Philippe Moreau and the team at Nantes, who basically have established that in first relapse in bortezomib-naive patients, the equivalence between sub-Q and IV has been validated in a phase 3 trial. The caution is that recognize who those patients are. They're bortezomib-naive, and they were actually in first relapse, almost all of them. The study was 1 to 3 priors, but the median number of priors was 1. So that's an important caveat, because if you are in the mix on your 7th or 8th line of therapy with a patient with very advanced aggressive disease, lots of extramedullary spread, and a lot of quote-unquote solid tumor behavior in their myeloma, I'm a little bit more cautious with sub-Q. And that's from my own experience, where I've seen patients in whom IV has been working, switch them to sub-Q for the purposes of improved tolerability, in particular reducing neuropathy, and I've seen loss of response. Now, this experience, frankly, is anecdotal. I can't tell you that it's a prospective evaluation, but I've also heard it from other colleagues, too, who I very much trust and respect. And I think we just have to be careful. So our own practice pattern, and there is science to support this observation, by the way, the Cmax in tumor models does appear to matter. It obviously appears to be equivalent in the clinic and in other models, but in certain myeloma models, and particularly in solid tumor models, in fact, Cmax does appear to be important to effect. So I think it's worth remembering that, only because if you've got a patient who can clearly benefit from sub-Q, absolutely, way to go, reduce neuropathy, make it more convenient. But be careful in your very advanced patients with resistant disease who've had multiple lines of prior therapy. And also recognize something too, which is that neuropathy can be managed in other ways. And that's an important point. And second of all, of course, sub-Q administration isn't without its challenges. The skin rashes can be an issue. Local irritation can be a challenge. But overall, I think sub-Q bortezomib has been an important step forward, a tremendous contribution and an option for patients. So great news. But again, like everything, you know, you have to put it in context and balance it.
So in terms of using, for example, VRD up front, what are the acceptable options in terms of utilizing bortezomib?
Well, I think, again, what I've found very useful, we have two approaches at our center. We use the classical RVD for particularly on protocol, obviously, and for younger patients in whom we need a robust, high-quality response, and then we're preparing them for transplantation or for other strategies. For older patients or patients who we're concerned may be more frail, we have a regimen we nickname it RVD Light. Now, this is actually going to be prospectively studied, and we're doing this jointly with my partner, Dr. Nupa Rajay. She's the director at the Mass General, and she and I are working together on a protocol which she's leading, which is basically RVD Light sub-Q versus IV. And we'll obviously generate data from this protocol to guide clinicians and caregivers and patients about optimal use. But right now, that RVD Light that we use is IV, generally speaking. And if we then encounter, and that, by the way, is weekly bortezomib with lenalidomide given over 3 weeks with then a 2-week rest period. And then what we do is we can use sub-Q in that setting as well. But I emphasize some degree of caution because remember, the sub-Q data was validated in the context of a day 1, 4, 8, and 11 schedule, not day 1, 8, 15, and 22. And I think, obviously, we're going to have data to support those schedules fairly soon. But in practice, I would say at our center, we're using sub-Q in about 20 to 30% of patients in whom it's appropriate, typically those with neuropathy that's a challenge. But for the majority of patients, we continue to use IV. Now, I know from friends and colleagues around the country and also key myeloma centers that they have approached this differently. Some, for example, have embraced sub-Q completely. And I completely understand why. At our own center, we've just elected to be a little bit more cautious.
So I want to ask you about new agents in a minute, but a couple more sort of, you know, basic clinical things. I see you have a paper in the journal Expert Reviews, along with a bunch of other people, looking at a kind of older topic, but one of continuing interest, which is renal dysfunction And there are a couple of really spectacular graphics in this paper. I love it.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you like it because I'm the senior author on that paper, and it was my mentee, a lovely chap, Mahmoud, who actually was the lead author, and he's done a beautiful job. Mahmoud is actually also a very talented artist, so those are actually his work.
So now we're in the audio media. We don't have the visual, but I just wonder if you could just talk a little bit conceptually about what you were trying to get across here in this paper.
Well, thank you. Neil, how nice of you to pick up that paper. I love that review. I'm very proud of Mahmoud. He's a very bright, and he's a first-year resident, by the way.
Wow.
And is a superstar. And he came for us as a medical student and had a lovely elective with us, which was a lot of fun. In any event, what Mahmoud and I sought to do in this paper was, I mean, I know you're the same, Neil. I love visuals, and I love the way you educate because it's so clear, and you distill complex issues to being relatively simplified. And I think that's one of the enormous strengths of your programs. And I think that we tried in this paper to do the same thing. By visualizing it for providers, you can see in a way that's fairly clear what the pathology is, because it's awfully complex. I mean, if you look at this under H&E, as you know, it's difficult to know what the heck's going on. But if you look at it graphically in the way that Mahmoud sought to present it, it starts to make sense. So what we were really seeking to do was to point to the complexity of renal injury and myeloma and all the factors that can contribute to it. And we were asked by the editors of the journal to provide a review that would be practical and useful to clinicians in the era of novel therapies. And that's exactly what we sought to do. And I think that what we wanted to do is best explain how things occur, you know, where the injury occurs, both in the glomerulus and in the interstitium and in the tubules, to understand the true entity of light chain deposition disease versus myeloma kidney, which is slightly different, and then very importantly, how that might be affected by drugs we use, be they bisphosphonates, be they conventional treatments, and to understand how to optimally use IMIDs and at the same time the absolutely central role that bortezomib plays in the management of renal disease and myeloma. So that was the goals of our paper. And I think it's particularly exciting because obviously now we have, following hot on the heels of bortezomib, are the second generation proteasome inhibitors. And the one word of caution actually is that these second generation proteasome inhibitors, including marizumib, which we know very well, but the far more advanced carfilzomib, which is really a super drug and it clearly appears to be poised for approval, I think, in the relatively near future, maybe. Well, we don't know exactly when, but maybe sooner versus later, we'll just have to see. But in any event, that drug, however, may not be the same across the nephron in the way bortezomib may be. Neither is marizumib. So I think this review of renal dysfunction is timely because I think it'll help clinicians understand that. Obviously, the point about carfilzomib is that it's much less neurotoxic. My own personal experience, insofar as it is, recognizing that we've got now use of the drug in the expanded access program, and I've referred patients to trials with carfilzomib, is that it's not without neurotoxicity, but it's much, much less. And I think it's been a very important advance. Marizumib, which is a drug we've been working with for some time, is fascinating, and it's completely different to both bortezomib and carfilzomib. Also has a renal signal as an irreversible proteasome inhibitor that you have to watch, but interestingly has pretty much no neuropathy either. Again, very mild. But interestingly, does have some CNS effects at higher dose, which have completely opened the door, Neil, to the fact that this may be a proteasome inhibitor of choice when you have CNS disease. And what's interesting about that is obviously we don't see that very commonly in myeloma, although we do see more leptomeningeal disease, interestingly enough. But of course, it may be one of the first proteasome inhibitors that we might start to apply in brain tumors and so forth.
So from a practical perspective, how do you approach the patient who presents with acute renal failure at first diagnosis of myeloma?
Oh, okay, right. Well, driving back to that, be very practical, Neil. Yeah, obviously managing electrolyte disturbance, managing hydration, avoiding nephrotoxins like CT contrast and non-steroidals, obviously, and at the same time maximizing steroid dosing. I personally love to use solumedrol because it has more mineralocorticoid effects, although, you know, particularly if the patient has some salt wasting, which can happen, and at the same time you get less metabolic disturbance than you might get with dexamethasone. Having said that, either dex or solumedrol are key drugs. And then obviously our drug of choice in the setting of renal failure is bortezomib. We also bring in cyclophosphamide in particularly challenging cases. We'll then introduce thalidomide cautiously dosed. And we've also had great luck with lenalidomide. But again, you have to be careful because it's renally cleared. And so you need to dose adjust and dose reduce quite aggressively to ensure adequate tolerance. But we've also been very interested in the work coming from Europe with these new optimized dialysis membranes, which are basically very interesting. And I think I'm hopeful in the US we'll have more access to them because they clearly do seem to be superior to our old-fashioned plasma exchange, which, as you know from the randomized trials, isn't as good a modality as these new high-output hemodialysis membranes appear to be.
So you mentioned carfilzomib, and at the ASH meeting in December, Dr. Jakubowiak presented, I guess for the second straight ASH meeting, so-called CRD. Can you talk a little bit about what was presented and what you thought about it?
I thought it was excellent. I mean, again, it's a lovely validation of the concept that you combine a proteasome inhibitor and an immunomodulator and see synergy. I think what's really exciting about Andre's CRD work is that on the one hand, it's a validation of the concept that you combine immunomodulation with proteasome inhibition and dexamethasone. And he's reported an overall response rate, 94%, with very high quality responses seen as well. But on the other hand, he's made a dramatic impact on neurotoxicity. And the treatment emergent neuropathy he reported was around 21%, as I recall. And obviously with RVD, we saw a much higher signal. And that's why I think this is such an important step forward, because he's dramatically reducing the neurotoxicity with his combination, but at the same time has very similar response outcomes. Now, interestingly, as Andre presented the data, I was struck that, like every good drug that works, there's side effect profiles you have to be aware of. And I think that what I saw, which was a little different, was there were significant rates of hyperglycemia, which we didn't see with the RVD platform. He also described some shortness of breath associated with infusions, which he ascribed to the need for fluid hydration that you need to do with this combination, because, as I mentioned earlier, there's this potential for a renal signal from carfilzomib, although I think with hydration it's essentially been dealt with, and the use of dex. But I think that's the point, is that it's very well tolerated. It's a great regimen, but like any active regimen, we have to be aware that there are different side effect profiles. That being said, I'm very struck by the success of this regimen. It's a day 1, 2, 8, 9, 15, 16 combination, and he runs the lenalidomide throughout. And I think that what I'm particularly excited about is to see how this evolves when, for example, we move to the oral version of carfilzomib, which is coming, where we can actually perhaps get around perhaps the only inconvenience of that, which is the IV stuff. But I was very impressed, Neil. I thought it was a tremendous presentation.
Oral carfilzomib. I haven't heard that one before.
Yep, it's coming, just so you know. I mean, it's in development. It's not quite ready for prime time because of some GI side effects, but it is in clinical trial now, and there is some really good work coming in that regard. I should mention that the other really exciting oral proteasome inhibitor is MLN9708, which is the boronate peptide that is actually now already in large-scale trials, both as a single agent and combination, and that seems to be very promising indeed.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, and I know you were one of the people who presented on that and asked, but just to finish out in terms of carfilzomib, I'm curious if the drug were approved right now or if you could access it, in what situations would you use it? And there are a couple things in particular I'm wondering. Any situation where you would use it up front, CRD? I mean, for example, let's say a patient with prior diabetic neuropathy.
I completely agree. I think that that's where I would think to. Now, remember, of course, it depends on what the regulations allow. But if the regulations specify its use in relapsed refractory disease, obviously there its clear position would be for patients with significant risk and or already neurotoxicity. The area of caution, frankly, I would be is those with significant renal dysfunction. I would approach them with some caution. Conversely, in the upfront setting, depending on the availability, of course, and one's ability to use it, a patient with significant risk of neurotoxicity, I would also consider CRD a combination potentially of choice. I think the important thing to remember is that the neurotoxicity signal from the CRD platform isn't zero. It is 21%. And so I think that one just has to also be aware of that and how to manage it. I think that that notwithstanding, that's how I would think of using it.
So you mentioned the MLN compound, the oral compound. Can you talk a little bit more about what we know about that at this point?
Well, I think it's undergone rapid and very well-organized phase 1-2 testing, both as a single agent and in combination with lenalidomide and dex. And in the upfront setting, the lenalidomide-dex MLN9708 combination presented by Dr. Jesus Badeja at the ASH meeting was quite dramatic. 100% response rate in evaluable patients to date, all oral regimen, very well tolerated apart from some manageable grade 1-2 skin rashes that were actually remarkably non-itchy but quite violaceous to exam. We were one of the lead enrollers to that trial, and we've been very pleased with the performance of the three drugs together. In the relapse setting, as a single agent, we've seen responses even clearly in bortezomib failure. So we're very pleased by that. The drug has some qualitative differences to bortezomib that make it very attractive. It's a rapid on, rapid off type pharmacology. It is a boronate peptide. It has this beauty of being orally bioavailable. And it doesn't appear to have anything like the neurotoxicity that bortezomib has. So again, a very important advance for patients.
So in other words, it's similar chemically to bortezomib, but not identical.
Yes, it's a boronate peptide, but it is specifically, I mean, it's been a very long project led by Dr. Eric Kupperman with this really well-designed molecule that is a rapid on, rapid off in terms of what it does. It's reversible, which is important from a toxicological point of view, and it basically appears to be devoid of the degree of neurotoxicity that we're used to seeing with bortezomib. It does have the skin tox, but it is manageable. And I think that's all to the good, because at the end of the day, it provides us then with an oral option for patients. And so what we now have with bortezomib, carfilzomib, MLN9708, and murizumib is, you know, four proteasome inhibitors right now to be thinking of as potential choices in the future.
So another new agent I want to ask you about is elotuzumab, and you've been involved with that. What exactly is it, and what do we know about it?
Well, elotuzumab is really probably one of the most promising antibodies we have now. It targets CS1, which is uniquely overexpressed by myeloma. And in combination with really some seminal work led by Dr. Sagalonial with lenalidomide combined with elotuzumab, the signal's been dramatic. And Andres Jakubowiak's also led work in combination with bortezomib and shown at least additive, if not synergistic, activity there as well. So I suspect it's a mixture of not only ADCC type mechanisms, but also apoptotic signaling that probably underlines the way this drug works. But it's probably myeloma's rituximab in my view. And I say that carefully because there are lots of other antibodies coming. So just like rituximab was the lead and now there are lots of other antibodies in lymphoma, I'm hopeful that in myeloma we're going to see the same. But elotuzumab's been a great step forward, generally well tolerated. You've got to watch out a little bit for infusional reactions. Pre-medications make a big difference. But it really doesn't have neurotoxicity, which is important. And at the same time, it's generally very well tolerated in my experience. So, you know, I'm very hopeful for it. I think it's a big step forward.
One other question before I ask you about a case. Where are you today in terms of bisphosphonates, particularly after the MRC study came out? Let's start with duration of treatment.
Great question. In that trial, patients were treated for up to 5 years with monthly infusions of zoledronic acid. The median exposure was around 2 years. But again, that was driven mainly by events related to their myeloma versus any actually fixed duration required for toxicological reasons. So I think that the important message from that trial is that we don't necessarily know about duration. What we do know, though, is that there was a survival advantage. And therefore, our own policy towards bisphosphonate use is to be quite proactive, but recognize there are important side effects, renal, importantly, which we touched on in the renal paper that you mentioned earlier. And at the same time, there is, of course, the entity of osteonecrosis of the jaw. What was very interesting from the Myeloma 9 trial from the United Kingdom was the incidence of ONJ in the zoledronic acid-treated patients was 3.5%, which is, I think, very important because it's a large 2,000-patient randomized trial. I think it gives you a real signal for the actual incidence rate of ONJ. And when you see it at that level, it's important. And for those people affected by it, it's obviously very important. But it is not the scourge that perhaps some people thought it was when the first cases of ONJ were being reported. I don't want anyone to minimize ONJ. It's an important complication, but I think we've gotten much better at managing it. And by so doing, have made, I think, bisphosphonate use that much more efficacious.
So in your own practice, how long do you continue it in a patient who's doing well?
I do it for at least 2 years. And then after 2 years, I will drop down to every 3 months or 2 to 3 months, depending on the clinical scenario. And obviously, I'm cautious if I run into any toxicities and back off accordingly. But I do have a very good oral medicine team, and we've been able to manage ONJ cases very successfully with a multidisciplinary approach and been able, interestingly enough, to then revisit bisphosphonates to help them with their bone disease once the ONJ is sorted out.
So another question that came off the MRC study was, what about using bisphosphonates or ZDA in people without bone disease?
Great question. Well, I think the reason that became so promising, Neil, was because, in fact, in the MRC9 trial, they showed that in patients without overt lytic bone disease, there was clinical benefit. And I think that lent a lot of support to what some of us do for smoldering patients who are not part of protocols, who have osteopenia, that there are actually randomized trials showing evidence of clinical benefit in these settings by virtue of time to first skeletal event, which obviously shouldn't be underestimated. I mean, that, you know, your first presenting event being a fracture is no small thing. So we in our own practice tend to be quite proactive with bisphosphonates, but recognize that the importance of being very careful about side effects.
So you submitted a few cases to discuss, but as usual, there was a lot to talk about. How about if we just discuss your 88-year-old patient?
Well, this actually is a lovely lady, basically, who presented with significant bone disease in the summer of 2009 and was originally hospitalized for pain control. She was found to have, with the lytic lesions, obviously a serum protein electrophoresis was one of the early lab tests done, and she had IgA lambda monoclonal gammopathy. She had high-risk features, actually, with a beta-2 microglobulin of 5.8 and a low serum albumin of 2.9. Bone marrow nailed the diagnosis with a plasmacytosis of 80%. And a skeletal survey was dramatic with really widespread diffuse bony lesions.
She was okay before this?
Relatively well, actually. Yes, absolutely. And remarkably, you know, she's a very fit woman in that regard.
And when you look back at the time preceding her diagnosis, did she have a lot of problems and maybe it was missed, or was this sort of a very rapidly evolving situation?
It's a great question. And I think that in her particular case, this was a relatively rapid situation. She would admit, though, that, you know, at 88, bony discomfort and aches and pains and a bit of fatigue are very difficult to sort out, you know, when you're at that age. You know, what is this? Arthritis, degeneration, and just, you know, one's maturing nicely and therefore fatigue is part of that process. Obviously, in her case, it reared its head. And what was really quite interesting for her was that she benefited from the use of bortezomib and dexamethasone. We also administered concurrent pamandronic acid. She did also require radiation therapy to her pelvic lesions, the big ones. And basically, she enjoyed, after just a relatively short course of bortezomib and dexamethasone, a 10-month progression-free interval. And she did have some intercurrent medical issues during that time that were unrelated to myeloma or treatment. But the question really was, what do one do after a relatively short exposure to bortezomib and dex? I should mention she did continue on pamandronic acid. You know, how would you treat her now at relapse?
Just to pick up on a couple of things before we go on to the relapse situation, what drove you to use pamidronate?
I think at that time, frankly, the concern was, you know, relative to her age and so forth, was some caution. And this was obviously antecedes the results of the myeloma 9 trial, which, as you know, became available somewhat after she was diagnosed. It was a drug of choice, particularly by her community doctor.
And what about the choice of bortezomib dex?
The choice there was driven primarily by the bone disease and her high-risk features. Her ISS stage was obviously worrisome with a beta-2 of 5.8 and an albumin of 2.9.
And what was her sort of general condition when you first met her? And was there any thinking, you know, well, maybe just leave this poor lady alone?
Yeah, that's a great question, Neil. And I love the way you phrased that, because that's the key point in her case. Key point in her case is that she was quite well until the diagnosis sort of started to rear its head. So you knew that she had a good functional status as reflected by her status prior to beginning treatment and prior to her diagnosis. So our feeling was it was very legitimate to manage her with a relatively aggressive regimen because, as you know, administering to an 88-year-old, bortezomib-based therapy might not in the community be the first choice of everyone.
And how did she do on the bortezomib dex?
Remarkably well. The dex actually was more of the problem than the bortez, and she really didn't experience more than grade 1 to 2 at most peripheral neuropathy. We did start her off on a twice a week initially, and in fact that was one of the decisions why she didn't stay on treatment for longer perhaps, and perhaps with the advent, for example, of sub-Q bortezomib, we might have been more proactive in her duration of bortezomib treatment. The other thing that drove her to sort of a relatively shorter course is this is very something specifically that she wanted, and at the same time she wasn't particularly interested in an aggressive maintenance strategy, and bisphosphonate alone was what she was interested in. The other thing is, was the decision to keep an IMID in reserve for later. This was driven by my colleague who was helping me with her care, when which I thought was a very reasonable choice on his part, you know, to keep it in reserve. Obviously, with what we know now from the VISTA trial and so on, you know, would we have perhaps given her RVD light and then kept the lenalidomide rolling? That might have actually been an approach we would use now.
So she gets the treatment for 4 cycles and radiation. And what was her quality of life?
Good. The radiation was very helpful for rapid pain control. And that was another reason why we didn't start with lenalidomide up front, because she was getting bortezomib dex, which isn't myelosuppressive particularly, but obviously lenalidomide can be. So that was one of the rationales for keeping it in reserve. She had a really robust response very early. Typical of IgA disease, Neil, actually, we see that sort of rapid response as the IgA disappears quickly and then can bounce back.
So 10 months later, she was progressing.
Well, my colleagues actually chose to treat her with a lenalidomide-based regimen, and actually they did choose an RVD platform because they felt to re-challenge her with bortezomib would be appropriate. We did discuss protocols, which would be an ideal choice for her, but for various sort of geographic reasons, that was difficult for her to come. And also, she was almost approaching 90, so it was very reasonable to go with a lenalidomide-based approach, low-dose weekly bortezomib, and then dial it down to less frequent administration. And obviously the goal ultimately is to move her to lenalidomide alone.
Now, did she become symptomatic again?
Oh, at the time of progression, yes, she had. Yeah, absolutely. And this is why actually the choice to bring bortezomib back in the mix was made, because she did in fact have some bone symptoms. So again, it was bony recurrence. And as we know, bortezomib is a sort of excellent drug of choice for bone disease. Lenalidomide, of course, is also exquisitely active, but it obviously has osteoclastic inhibition, but it doesn't appear to have profound effects on the osteoblast, which is, of course, what bortezomib does. Now, I will share with you that with her, when they chose the RVD salvage regimen, it was very attenuated. Weekly bortezomib, lenalidomide at low dose, just at 5 milligrams.
And what's her current situation?
On last checks, she's doing very well in remission.
So RVD in a 90-year-old?
Low dose.
Low dose.
And in fairness, you know, she's 89, but yes.
89, okay, sorry.
Yeah.